There is no shaking the factual statements of the text. Joseph sold to those who had property, that is, to the haughty district barons and owners of large estates, at the highest price the market would bear, and put money, that is to say, exchange, into the royal treasury, so that soon there was no money, in the narrower sense of the word, that is to say, precious metal in any form, among the people. Money, in the sense of coin, there was none, and all sorts of cattle had always been among the exchange values given for corn. That was not cause and effect, nor was it any rise of prices. Any picture suggesting that Joseph used the scarcity of currency to take away the inhabitants' horses, oxen, and sheep is only a partial picture. Cattle are money, too. They are money in the most definite sense, as is clear from our modern word, pecuniary. And even before the well-to-do paid with their gold and silver vessels, they paid with their flocks and herds. There is, however, no mention of their passing over the last cow to Pharaoh's stables and pens. It was not stalls and sheepfolds that Joseph had built for 7 years on end, but granaries, and he would not have had space or use for all that cattle money. If one is ignorant of the methods of moneylenders, certainly one cannot follow a story like this. The cattle were loaned, or pawned, whichever you prefer. They remained for the most part on the estates and farmyards, but they ceased to belong to the occupants, in the old sense of the word. That is, they were their property, and yet they were not. It was only conditionally, and as a lien on the property. And if our first authority fails us anywhere, it is here. It does not give the clear impression, which nevertheless it is so important to get, that Joseph's proceedings had as their consistent goal the dislocation of the property concept and its transformation into a state which was neither ownership nor not ownership, but a conditioned feudal tenure. For as 1 year of drought and low water was added to another, as the face of the harvest queen remained averted, no grass grew nor any grain, as the womb of Mother Earth was closed and she left no child of hers to prosper, then great parts of the black earth which up till now had been in private hands passed to the crown. For the text has it, "And Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for the Egyptians sold every man his field." For what? For seed corn. Scholars agree that this must have been towards the end of the succession of hungry years, when the bonds of infertility began to loosen, the rainfall returned to more or less normal, and the fields would have been capable of yield if one could have sown them. Hence the words of the petitioners, "Wherefore shall we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants unto Pharaoh. And give us seed, that we may live and not die, that the land be not desolate." Who is it speaking? These are spoken words, not a cry from the people. It is a proposal, an offer, made by individuals, a group, a class of men up till then very untractable and antagonistic, the great estate owners and district princes, on whom Pharaoh Akhmose, at the beginning of the dynasty, had to confer great titles, like First King's Son of the Goddess Nekbet, and great independent landed possessions as well. They were old-fashioned, recalcitrant feudal lords, whose out-of-date methods, injurious to the general weal, had long been a thorn in the flesh of the modern state. Joseph, the statesman, exploited the crisis to force these arrogant gentlemen into compliance with the spirit of the times. It was they with whom, in the first instance, the exploitations and migrations we hear of had to do. What happened under this wise and resolute minister was the breaking up of the still existing large estates and the settling of peasant owners on the smaller ones, farmers who became responsible to the state for an up-to-date management, improvement of the canals, and irrigation of the soil. The result was a more even distribution of the land among the people, and an improvement of agriculture under crown supervision. Many first sons of the king became such tenant peasants, or moved into the town. Many a farmer was taken from the soil he had worked and put on one of the newly divided small properties, while his own passed into stranger hands. And if these shifts were practiced in other cases, If one hears that the Lord of Bread parceled out the people by cities, that is to say, in districts lying round about cities, and from one soil to another, Joseph did this in accordance with a deliberate policy of education involving that very remodeling of the property concept into something which was both preservation and abrogation. The essential condition for all state requisition of state property was the continuation of the levy of the fifth part, the same tax by means of which, during the fat years, Joseph had amassed the magic store into which he now dipped. It was the promulgation of this tax in permanence, its confirmation to everlasting time. Note that this imposition, without the shifting of populations, would have been the only form in which the sale of the lands, together with their occupants, for the occupants were included in the bargain, could have expressed itself. It has never been sufficiently emphasized that Joseph made only nominal use of this feature, the sale of themselves by the small farmers to which they had consented in order not to be ruined. Nobody has pointed out that for his own part, Joseph never used the word slavery or villainage, which, for easily understood reasons, he did not like. The imposition of the tax meant in itself that land and people were no longer free in the old sense. It received no stronger emphasis, but in actual practice, it meant that those who were provided with seed corn no longer worked exclusively for themselves, but partly for Pharaoh, in other words, for the state, the public land. To this extent, their labor was the forced labor of serfs. Every friend of humanity is free to use the word, if at the same time he is ready to apply it to himself as well. And yet, if we observe the measure of serfdom which Joseph laid upon those who submitted to it, we shall feel that it can scarcely be called by that name without exaggeration. If he had forced them to surrender three-quarters or even a half of their crops, that would have made them more sensible of the fact that they themselves and their fields no longer belonged to them. But 20 out of 100? Malice itself must concede that that was keeping the exploitation within bounds. 4/5 of their harvest remained to the people for the new sowing and their own and their children's food. In view of this, it is allowable to speak of the serfdom as nominal. Down the centuries ring the words of gratitude with which those under the yoke greeted their oppressor. Thou hast saved our lives. Let us find grace in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants.